Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. In recent years, Palestinians felt abandoned as the Arabs and the Israelis forged new economic-based relationships encouraged by the United States. The plight and problems of millions of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank became almost invisible to almost all except themselves. The attacks on October 7th and the ongoing brutal Israeli response changed that, perhaps forever. Indeed, it's hard to imagine how ordinary Palestinians will ever recover, not just from the direct casualties of the war, but from the erasure of even the most ordinary rudiments of secure, predictable lives. All wars end, and this one will as well. But the people who survive, especially the almost 50% of Gazans under the age of 18, will surely be marked for life. So what? I know that sounds harsh, but it's a question that demands answers. Could the tragedy of war somehow lead to better lives for millions of Palestinians? Could Palestine become a state sharing in the prosperity envisioned by the Abraham Accords? Or are Palestinians condemned to remain stuck in whatever circle of Dante's hell they now inhabit? No one knows the answers, but my guest today brings a sort of experience and insight that at least could give us a window on possibilities. Francesca Bori is an Italian journalist who lives part of the time since 2007 in the West Bank and who is respected by Arabs as well as Israelis. Proof point. She was the first Western journalist to interview Yahya Sinwar in 2018. Welcome, Francesca, to New Thinking for a New World.
Ciao.
Let's start with Sinwar. I read your interview with him, published in La Repubblica, but also the op-ed that you published in a Norwegian paper after his death, sort of bookends. Both were extraordinary journalism. One of the things that struck me in your 2018 conversation with him was his offer, he talked about an unconditional ceasefire, nothing for nothing, and see what happens. Was he serious?
I think so. As you can imagine, you know, after October 7th, I've been asked, you know, this question over and over again by, well, first of all, by Israelis, because that interview was run front page by Yediot Ahronot, which is Israel's largest, you know, newspaper. October 2018, 6th of October. It sounds like a lifetime ago. The point is, you know, that interview, as most of my work actually, it wasn't like, you know, 20 minutes together, half an hour together, 1 hour together with Yahya Sinwar. No. I spent months in Gaza in 2018 because 2018 was the year of the March of Return. The March of Return was actually an initiative of Palestinians, not Hamas, not Fatah. Palestinians were really fed up with everything, including Hamas and Fatah. They were, you know, living under, well, the borders have been closed since 2006, basically, no? And they started walking, you know, toward the barrier, the fence, you know, toward Israel, basically, toward, peacefully, with the idea, you know, to escape. And for months. And then Hamas basically somehow, you know, started organizing these weekly demonstrations. But again, at the beginning was, you know, a Palestinian initiative. And so Hamas tried everything, you know, tried violence and nonviolence, even peaceful demonstrations, you know. So at the end of 2018, with most Palestinians against him and no way to, let's say, unblock, you know, the situation, Yahya Sinwar decided to a new option, you know, engaging Israel and addressing Israel. And yes, I mean, getting a deal. And that's why I am 99% sure, you know, of course I can be wrong, that, you know, he was not lying. He was not trying to, you know, to mislead Israel. No, because after that interview, the title was I Don't Want War Anymore. After that interview also, for several months, there was a direct channel between Yahya Sinwar and Israel and Netanyahu, who was already prime minister. And I know, you know, because I was not involved, but of course, you know, I remember very well, you know, there were these meetings, there were these exchange of messages. And the point is, Hamas was very weak and Israel was very strong at the time, you know, because we didn't know. But Netanyahu was, you know, negotiating much more than that. He was not only negotiating with Hamas, he was negotiating, you know, with Ben Zayed for the Abraham Accords, you know. And then in 2020, you know, we were under lockdown, there was COVID, you know, and Palestinians were totally forgotten. And in the meantime, in 2021, you know, we had another war in Gaza. And then in 2021, when, you know, suddenly we basically read, you know, in newspapers about this agreement between Israel and the Emirates, I went to meet Khaled Meshaal, who is, you know, one of the founders of Hamas and by far still today the most charismatic member of the Politburo, you know, the former head of Hamas. And I met him for another interview, and that interview was the opposite of, you know, my interview with Yahya Sinwar. So after the Abraham Accords, you know, Hamas changed. That's why I say, yes, you know, that was really a missed opportunity in 2018.
So what led Hamas, Sinwar in particular, to October 7th? That complete failure of 5 years earlier, the effort?
Yes, I think honestly, we will never know for sure. But I think, you know, Hamas was in a corner until October 6th. I was, you know, in Jenin for most of this so-called third intifada, which means 2022. So on October 7th, 2023 had already been the bloodiest year, I mean, in terms of death toll for Palestinians since the end of the Second Intifada. Palestine, I mean, both Gaza and the West Bank were boiling. I mean, were boiling then. And the settlers were, you know, attacking everything and everyone. And Palestinians were totally forgotten. Totally, totally. You know, after that interview with Yahya Sinwar in 2018, you know, we had COVID, then we had Ukraine. I know very well, you know, because I arrived in Ramallah for the first time in 2007. I was still a university student. And then, you know, with the Arab Spring, I was in Syria and Iraq. I mean, I'm a war reporter, no? But every 2-3 months, I always came back to Ramallah, which was somehow my home, and also because I write for Israel's main newspaper. And all other journalists, you know, were wondering why, you know, I was going back to such an irrelevant place, you know, and this until October 6th. And absolutely, in Jenin, there were just, you know, we were just three journalists. And there was also Gideon Levy for Haaretz, and there was Mariam Barghouti for Al Jazeera. So no Western media, no international media, you know, but we knew what was happening, you know. So the point is, Hamas was in a corner, you know, totally in a corner. And until October 6th, Palestinians in Gaza were absolutely against Hamas, absolutely against Hamas. And yes, and Palestinians were forgotten. And this is, I mean, I'm speaking, you know, because I spoke with Hamas leaders, what they planned on October 7th was a little bit different, which doesn't justify, of course, you know, Yahya Sinwar, because basically the idea, as far as I understand, as we understand, was a smaller attack, is fewer hostages, to try to get in exchange the end of the siege of Gaza, and to try to take power, you know, in the West Bank. So it was a different operation, a different scale, and another mistake of Yahya Sinwar. Yahya Sinwar was absolutely, you know, sure about an Arab, you know, intervention. And this is totally, you know, in line with Yahya Sinwar as I knew him. Because if there is, you know, he was very, he listened to everybody before deciding, but once he decided something, he could crush everything and everyone in front of him, but he would go, you know, straight. And this happened also, you know, with my interview in 2018, when he had a minority against that interview, against the idea of opening, you know, a direct channel with Israel. And when I asked him, but, you know, how much of Hamas is behind you in this decision to speak directly with Israel? And he said, well, I have against, you know, about 30, 40% of Hamas in Gaza, which is a lot already, no? He didn't care. He decided, you know, to speak with Israel. He did it. And at the same, in the same way, on October 7, he decided, you know, to attack. And basically, he said little, you know, to even to the other leaders of Hamas, you know, to Fatah, to the other Palestinians, to Palestinians, actually. He didn't really say anything, anyone, about, you know, his plan. Then the plan probably went, you know, beyond what was planned.
So, consequence. I saw a piece by Hassan Jaber who argued, you may have seen this, that now Sinwar will be seen as a symbol of revolution and resistance for years to come. I don't know what that means in practice. Do you think what do you think his legacy is? And does it matter?
I think it is too early. Because, you know, there is a missing tile in all our, you know, analysis and Palestinians in Gaza. Palestinians in Gaza, you know, are bearing the brunt of, you know, Yahya Sinwar's decisions more than anyone else, you know. And if I know Gaza a little bit, you know, Palestinians in Gaza, when finally they will speak again, you know, they will be furious with Hamas, with Israel, with international community, with the West Bank, with the Palestinian Authority, with all of us, no, with all of us. So I think, you know, that to assess the legacy of Yahya Sinwar, we have to wait for what Palestinians in Gaza will have to say. But it's also somehow, you know, you were talking about, you know, this last image, you know, of the last moments of his life when, you know, he's throwing this stick, you know, at the drone which is chasing him. And, well, yes, you know, if you are in the Arab world now, it's kind of a legend. But that image is also, you know, its opposite, because you can read that image as, yes, an image of defiance, an image of resistance until, you know, your last moments, or exactly the opposite, the idea, you know, that because Sinwar took there is another picture of Sinwar, quite famous, taken after October 7th. He, at some point, you know, he resurfaced from the tunnels. And there is this picture, he's sitting on a chair, an armchair in the rubble, smiling like, you know, I'm the king. Well, yes, the king of the ruins, the king of the rubble, the king of the devastation, you know. And what's left? A stick against the drones. You just, you know, you just threw back with that stick. You threw back Gaza to the Middle Age, to the Stone Age. I know that probably, you know, when you say this, Palestinians and Arabs immediately say, oh, Israel threw back Gaza to the Stone Age, not Hamas. Let's wait a little bit, you know. And I think also that the legacy, you know, which one of the two images will prevail in the end for the kids of Gaza now, you know, it's also up to us, you know.
Let's talk about the Stone Age, because that's a good metaphor. Place has been destroyed. Lives are turned upside down, inside out. Kids haven't been in school for however long it's been so far. There's malnutrition, there's food problems, there's all of the horrors of war in this tiny little space. It's sort of Alistair Horn's War in a Savage Place kind of image. How do the people recover? Or is it Dante's Circle of Hell?
Palestinians won't recover. Look, I'm a war reporter, and my trademark is I live with the people I write about, which means I probably spent one night in a hotel in the last 10 years. And I live with the poorest of the poor, which means you can't imagine what a war is when, you know, you are not anymore with your fixer, your translator, your security guy, and you are just with civilians. And, you know, I studied international law. I actually wanted to work in international criminal court. Well, there is no such thing as civilians and combatants in a war. You know, there is not even a front line. There is just a front area, and everything is a target. Everything is a target. And, you know, the first thing that you learn in war, wherever there is a place like a hospital, a bread line, wherever there is a gathering of civilians, oh, that's the danger. There is an airstrike, there is an ambulance going there. That's the danger, because someone is going to hit again and to bomb again. This is what I learned in Aleppo, and this is what I, you know, I've lived in Gaza in 2014, the last war when, you know, where we could enter. And no, you will never recover, you know, and never. And personally, you know, when Nasrallah was killed, all Syria, you know, came back to my mind. And I spent, you know, I think 3 days talking with Syrian refugees everywhere in the world. And we were celebrating the death of Nasrallah. I know I shouldn't say that, but I think, you know, whoever has been under airstrikes, whoever has been stopped by a checkpoint run by Hezbollah in Syria, you know, remember the cruelty, you know, and so you will never recover. No, and Palestinians will never recover. The point is, at some point you find a way, you know, to leave. The point is, how many Palestinians will stay? Because there is usually after 1 year, 1 year and a half, you know, the difference is in schools. After 1 year, 1 year and a half, when you see that your children, you know, are still not in school, you leave. This is what we have seen with Syrian refugees, you know, when we had the exodus toward Europe. For several months, they stayed in Turkey, they stayed in Lebanon, they stayed in Jordan. At some point, you know, they just left. So this will happen in Gaza. And at some point, Palestinians will leave. And Gaza doesn't exist anymore, because it's not just its buildings, you know. And Gaza is lost, you know. And then if you want, you know, I can say something about, you know, yes, with time, you know. No, with time, nothing. You know, a war is forever.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
To leave, they have to open the doors, though. Do you think the Israelis would eventually open the doors? Or the Egyptians allow the doors to be opened?
You don't need to open the doors. You need to do, for example, what Spain is doing now in the West Bank, silently, suddenly. It's been so easy. It's becoming so easy to get a Schengen visa. You just go to the consulate of Spain in East Jerusalem and you get it suddenly. Now, I'm sure that Spain doesn't want, you know, to help, you know, Israel kicking out Palestinians. Spain supports Palestine, and so probably this is the way Spain wants to support Palestinians. You know, there is a deep economic crisis in the West Bank, but this is what happens, you know, because of course, you know, let's also remember, I'm based in Kabul, you know, and this is a rule, you know. Every time there is a crisis or a war like this, you think, you know, that the attention of the media will be, I don't want to say forever, but at least until, you know, the crisis will be. No, suddenly media will leave. It happened with Afghanistan, it happened with Ukraine, you know, until 6th of October, all our headlines were for Ukraine. And then suddenly we forgot even Ukraine, you know, which is somehow our war. and nothing, you know, we forgot it in 24 hours, you know. So at some point we will forget again also Palestinians, you know, and Palestinians will leave. Of course we leave, you know. Look, in Lebanon, for example, you know, we keep saying that there are 500,000 refugees. Yes, it's true, registered refugees with UNRWA. A few years ago, I think it was 2018 or 2019, Palestinians held, you know, the first census ever. And, well, they are 80,000, 80, in Lebanon, you know, refugees. Everybody left. Because when Syrians left for Europe, Palestinians, you know, left like many Lebanese, you know. So the point is, we will see many Palestinians will leave Palestine. And again, you know, I would say not just because of Israel, but also because of Hamas and Fatah, because of the Palestinian Authority. And I was reading this morning, you know, the economic analysis for the future. Both West Bank and Gaza, the idea is that basically now already Palestine is back to the end of the second intifada, the human development index, you know. So only, you know, to remove the rubble in Gaza, this will take 14 years, if, you know, tomorrow Israel opens, you know, Rafah and we can take away the rubble. Do you really think, you know, if you were a Palestinian from Gaza, would you stay?
Of course not. Of course not.
I'm not saying that by leaving, Palestinians will forget Palestine. Because, of course, you know, the Palestinian identity is quite different, you know, from most other national identities, you know. And of course, war and conflict strengthens, you know, this kind of identities. You know, we have seen it with the Ukrainians, you know, that became more Ukrainians, you know, when they were basically attacked by Russia. So, of course, you know, leaving doesn't mean, you know, forgetting or, you know, the point is, you know, I'm really at home in Palestine. So, of course, you know, as for me, it's quite, you know, when I see international journalists, you know, they get the kind of you know answers that, you know, there is a first layer of answer, you know. Do you want to leave? No, never. Because this is my homeland and blah 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 blah. And then, you know, when you just, you know, talk with Palestinians and especially with young Palestinians over a tea, over a coffee, or, you know, just, you know, because I live there, of course everybody wants to leave, you know. There is a strong social pressure, of course, you know, terrible social pressure. And but that's the world today, you know. We all want to leave.
But the kids, I assume, are connected through social media to the rest of the world. It's they don't live completely in isolation. They have some connectivity, don't they? However poor.
Of course. And social media and actually internet was one of, you know, the key factors in the Arab Spring, you know, because now, of course, you know, we all know what the world looks like, you know, basically outside our rooms, you know, and especially in the Middle East, especially, well, in Gaza, you know. The point is, when it comes specifically to Gaza and the West Bank, to young Palestinians, you know, social media totally replaced media, you know. No one is going to watch, you know, the BBC. There is only one channel, which is Al Jazeera, Arabic, not Al Jazeera English, and then social media. And there is, for example, you know, a Telegram channel for the resistance. I mean, it's called Resistance Network or something like that, you know. And usually I follow, you know, including when I am, you know, I don't know, in Jenin, you know, and I follow what happens, you know. In other cities or in Gaza, through this channel, you know. And it's weird, you know, because basically, I don't know, there is an attack in Gaza, you know, where you have a tank that, you know, opens fire on, Hamas fighters that, you know, attack a tank and kill, I don't know, three soldiers, you know. And then you have usually Hamas fighters, you know, record their operations, you know. I have to say that they remind a lot the ISIS fighters because it's also the same style, honestly, the video style. Anyway, so immediately, you know, you have on Al Jazeera and you have on Telegram, on Instagram, on Facebook, you know, these videos coming from Gaza. And you see the same video for 1 week, 10 days, you know, including on Al Jazeera. And it's always the same video. But the idea that you get is that, you know, there are so many Hamas fighters, you know, firing at so many tanks and so many Israeli soldiers killed. So really, you know, the social media, you know, when you are, you know, change, you know, and somehow, you know, the reshape, you know, the reality. And I remember, you know, the first major riot in Jenin, which was really, you know, the beginning of this third intifada. It was the end of 2022. It lasted 6 hours. At the time, you know, it was really unthinkable, you know, 6 hours. And it really, I was in a refugee camp. It was during the night. And so for 6 hours, you know, basically, I don't know, it was, you know, we were just staying indoors, of course, you know, and from the sound, the gunfire, it looked like a battle, you know, and from what I was reading and, you know, on Telegram, you know, it looked like, I don't know, really, you know, a battle. And then in the end was nothing. I mean, was nothing. It was just gunfire. When everything was over, there were just 2 Palestinians killed. And I was really thinking, you know, from Telegram, okay, we will find 70 dead. And this is something that, you know, anytime you happen to be in a refugee camp during a ride, and from the refugee camp, you follow the ride on Instagram, you know, there is, you know, a ride in front of you and there is a ride in social media, you know. And in the ride in front of you, Palestinians will be furious for what I'm going to say, but in the ride in front of you, the IDF is always winning. And in the ride on Instagram, Hamas is always winning, you know. Okay, now the point is, you know, the truth is, you know, that yes, that IDF crushed the resistance in the West Bank, whatever you can read, you know, in social media. The point is, you know, Palestinians get their information through social media. So no matter what we say on the BBC, and what they see is a different reality.
The point is that truth has become a relative concept.
Yeah.
Our understanding of truth is filtered by media. It's filtered by what we see outside our windows. It's filtered by the internet. And we all believe those truths. And that is a root cause of a lot of the tension in our societies.
And for me, actually, as a journalist, you know, I was always been living with, I live with those I write about. The point is, it's true, you know, that now with internet, we are basically surrounded by information, even too much, you know. My feeling is also that, you know, we don't see what is happening. I mean, if you think of Israelis, you know, Israelis don't get any image from, you know, what's happening in Gaza, except for the images, you know, of their own soldiers taking selfies, you know, as they burn everything. The same is true for Palestinians. Palestinians basically never got the image of October 7th, never. And we didn't get, in Europe and the United States, we didn't get those images because, you know, the Netanyahu, I mean, the Israeli government decided not to show to the general public all the images that was showing first to Israeli journalists and then to international journalists. I think this was a mistake. As a, you know, journalist from Yediot Ahronot, I could see all the images since the beginning, and that's why it was so complicated for me to explain to other Western journalists what really happened. And then I realized that simply the difference was that I saw more images than the others. Still today, you have yet to see, you know, the old image of October 7th. This was a choice, you know, out of respect for the victims, even if, you know, somehow damaged Israel. But anyway, whatever the number of images, you know, Palestinians didn't see anything, you know. I remember when I went to Kfar Aza, one of the kibbutzim, you know, of October 7th, where actually my photographer, the photographer of Yediot Ahronot, was killed. And I had a Palestinian driver from Jerusalem, and was quite tough, you know. He was, of course, treated in an extremely rude way, but by all the Israelis that, you know, we came across. At the same time, I have to say, when we arrived in Kfar Aza, I mean, we parked the car and he didn't get off. He's Jerusalem, very, very moderate. He hates Hamas. And he said, "I don't care." He didn't get off. He didn't want to see Kfar Aza, which I can tell you, I'm a war reporter, you know. Not all scene of war is the same, you know. Kfar Aza, as Beheri, as, you know, Nirods, was not the scene of a battle, of a, you know, I don't know, a clash. No, was more like, you know, butchery. Was the scene of a... Of I don't know, like, okay, a serial killer was here. Was not like the ruins of I don't know, of Mosul, or the ruins of Raqqa, or the ruins of, you know, whatever, Donetsk. No, was totally different, you know? And the driver said, "I don't care."
Francesca, let's leave it there, because I think that summarizes precisely the problem. Precisely the problem. Thank you very much for this conversation. And I only have one addendum. Please stay safe.
No, I'm, you know, safer in Jenin than in Europe, you know.
I'm not going to tell my European friends that, but I think you're right.
No, you know, when I was in Aleppo, it was my first war, especially as a journalist, you know. And of course, that the first war marks you forever. And the point is, you know, nobody in 3 years and a half, nobody ever asked me, "Oh, what are you doing?" No, now I got used to it. So after 10 years, you know, I got used not to being asked, you know, "How are you doing?" But in this case, you know, in the case of Gaza, and I think, look, I don't care, because I'm the one who should ask, "Hey, how are you doing?" You know, there's this war, you know, October 7th and October 8th, and also October 6th, honestly, you know, in front of you. And you didn't do anything, you know. So, guys, you have a problem, you know. I think definitely I'm safer in Israel and Palestine, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Ciao.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.